The Cambie Report was produced and recorded on the traditional and unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Kwikwetlem peoples.
September 9th, 2022, and there are 36 days left until the Vancouver municipal election. This is the Cambie Report. I'm Matthew Naylor.
And I'm Ian Bushfield.
Hi, everyone. We've got a very interesting show for you today. A bunch of parties have released housing platforms. Mario Canseco is going to be joining us to talk about his recent poll with Research Co. And of course, we have gone into mourning for our beloved sovereign's death.
At least 50% of the podcast has. The one thing we will not be doing, though, is suspending our podcasting activities. Unlike the opposition One Burnaby political party, which I got a press release from yesterday saying we will be immediately suspending campaigning in Burnaby municipal election in order to observe the death of the sovereign. And they attached to that a statement recognizing her service to the country.
That is a lot. I feel like people should feel free to continue to participate in their constitutional democracy, even as the transition of the head of state occurs. Take a day off for the funeral, maybe?
Yeah, Twitter was very weird yesterday with like people either over-mourning, especially brands, like, and brands that shouldn't probably be mourning the queen, like the Les Miserables cast.
What?
Don't need to necessarily, you like, it's fine to say nothing. And then the other half of Twitter was people making off-color jokes, and that's where I was, and that's all fine. But like, there are clear protocols written out in terms of who needs to take time off and do what. Nothing is said about your local political party. No one's going to be upset if you're still campaigning. Say something nice. That's fine. Politicians are expected to say something pro forma, but you can keep doing your politics. Just maybe don't announce your Republican platform yesterday.
Yeah, go campaign in all black. You can't see it because this is, of course, a podcast, but I am dressed in all black, and that has nothing to do with the fact that I need to wear it for my job. It's entirely queen-related.
I guess One Burnaby is just going to eat a couple days of campaign time, but everyone else will be continuing to campaign. I did get a DM from a random political party being like, should we suspend our campaign? And I was like, no, you're asking the wrong guy, but no.
But also no. Yeah.
No one cares. No one cares.
Before we continue, we should beg for money a little bit. Please visit patreon.com/CambieReport. It is your source for citizen journalism in Vancouver and its environs. We literally could not do the show without your support. It funds our freedom of information request. It gets you access to our Slack channel, and it makes you part of our Cambie Report community. That's patreon.com/CambieReport.
And a big shout out to the few people who've been signing up recently. I've noticed a slow uptick, and it's nice to see new people joining the Cambie Report community. So thank you very much.
Welcome aboard.
With that, let's throw it over to our interview with Mario Canseco.
Joining us today is Mario Canseco of Research Co. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure. Great to be here with you.
So it's great to have you back. It's been a while since we had you on the podcast, but you have a new poll out on the state of the race in Vancouver. We talked recently about the poll from Forum that the team party put out a couple weeks ago. That was actually from early or late July, but these numbers are newer. So what did you find, Mario?
It's a very convoluted race, I have to say. The numbers for Kennedy Stewart and Ken Sim a little bit higher than the level of support they had in the last election. Kennedy Stewart at 35% with decided voters, Ken Sim at 30%. Colleen Harwick in a third place at 17%, and Mark Morrison at 13%. So what makes this different from 2018 is you have four candidates in double digits. We never had that the last time around, even when you had people such as Hector Bremner running or Wai Young or even Fred Harding. It was usually a couple of front runners and a third place finisher, which is ultimately what happened with Shauna Sylvester. But it's still early stages. We still have 5 weeks to go. We have 16% of likely voters who are undecided, which is crucial. These are people who have participated in elections before, who are certain that they're going to be voting in this one. And about one in six of them just don't know who they want to vote for at this point.
And how many of those people are likely to vote, of those one in six who are undecided so far.
What we do in this case, and this is something that we try for every election that we cover, is to focus on the likely voter. This is somebody who participates in elections, whether it's federal, provincial, in the case of the United States, state, local, and federal, who is expressing a willingness to vote in the next election, who voted in the previous election, which is a much better way of looking into the voters than if you're just calling everybody on the phone or even doing it online and not actually gathering any data about their voting history. So this is why we have this level of undecided. For likely voters, it's very high to have 16% who don't know who they're going to be supporting. If we had asked everybody who lives in the city without factoring in for likely voters, then the number of undecideds would be closer to 30%.
So your sample was 400 people, but it was from a larger pool where you weeded out those people who said they're probably not going to vote, because in a municipal election where 40% of people vote, you got to just ignore the people who aren't going to turn.
Well, that is definitely the essence of all of the electoral forecasts that we've done at ResearchGo since 2018. We've done 46 elections already. And what's important is to figure out the likelihood to vote. You look at voting history, you look at the actual perceptions in the race, you look at whether people are following the race closely or not, what type of engagement do they have in the early stages of the campaign. But the voting history is the really crucial aspect here. And this is what enables us to look at into this particular electorate in a much different fashion. As you can see, we don't have 35% or 40% undecided voters, which is usual for municipal polls where you don't factor in for likely voters.
So is that assessment made like prior to phoning them, or is that something that you do via questioning, like making the decision whether or not they count as a likely voter?
It's part of the questionnaire design. So we ask the questions online. We ask a question about who you voted for in the last election. We ask a question about whether you're actually going to vote in the next election. And those are the ones that we want to talk to. If you're somebody who didn't vote the last time, if you're somebody who's not planning on voting this time around, then we don't want to talk to you anymore. We've reached the threshold of the usability that we have for that particular respondent. And part of the problem sometimes with questionnaire design is that you ask those questions at the end. You've had somebody for 10 minutes talking about municipal issues, and then you realize at the end that they're not going to be voting and they didn't vote the last time and they don't remember who they voted for. That's probably a person who's not going to be casting a ballot.
So let's come back to some of the numbers. And before we get more into the horse race numbers, you asked a couple other questions about the issues facing people. And I gloss over some of those a lot of the time, but I think they're always interesting. Unsurprisingly, housing is a leading issue. But dig into it a bit. What did you find when you asked about the issues people are concerned about, and how has it changed since 2018?
But there's still an emphasis on housing. 35% of people, of likely voters who we spoke to, say that it's the number one issue facing the city. What is quite interesting now is the level of concern is higher with Generation X. People aged 35 to 54 are more likely to be concerned about housing than what we see with the younger demographics or the oldest demographics when it comes to likely voters. So what we used to see in years prior was the younger voter being very concerned about the way housing was going. This is essentially renters who want to get into the market. And now it encompasses everybody. We used to have the 55 and overs more worried about property taxes, and it's at 19% with this group. But 32% say housing is the number one issue. Poverty is a bigger concern for the younger crowd at 11%. And crime as well, climbing the charts with the over 55s, but only at 9% at the citywide level. And this is essentially a way in which you can tell that the campaign is going to be designed for the candidates themselves to engage on the housing issue. We've seen the NPA come out hard about crime, but crime is the top concern for 9% of residents. And when we asked a Metro Vancouver question in August, crime is only climbing the charts, if you will, in Surrey. So a campaign that is based solely on restoring crime and dealing with the situation related to safety is probably not going to resonate as much as somebody who discusses housing.
And the other big issue on that list there is drug overdoses at 14%.
Yes, this is understandable from the situation that we had over the past few weeks. We had the latest numbers about how many people have been affected by what is happening. And what's really crucial to me right now, looking into those numbers, is now you have drug overdoses as an issue surpassing crime. And for a long time, crime was ahead. It was mostly a secondary concern would be the drug overdoses. And now, because of the situation that we find ourselves in, drug overdoses is higher, particularly with men at 17% and the younger residents, the younger likely voters at 18%. In downtown Vancouver, it's at 19%. So it's the number two issue in downtown Vancouver after housing. And this definitely plays a role in the way in which people are going to make decisions about this. I wasn't expecting it to be the number two issue, but right now it is.
So you found that there was a substantial regional breakdown in terms of where people were caring about drug overdoses. There was 19% in downtown Vancouver. In another areas, much lower, I assume?
Much lower, yes. On the west side, it's 13, so it's tied with crime. And on the east side, it's at 11%, significantly lower than the 39% who are worried about housing. But it could turn into a wedge issue in a way, because you have a significant proportion of the population that is looking into policies related to this. It's also quite striking when you look at the numbers by who they voted for in the mayoral election of 2018. People who voted for Shauna Sylvester or Kennedy Stewart are significantly more likely to be worried about this than people who voted for Ken Sim. Sim voters from 2018, drug overdoses is at 8%. The secondary concern after housing for them is property taxes. So yeah, you have, once again, the west side, east side divide that we had in the Vision and MPA years. People on either side of Main Street concerned about different things.
Was there any other standout issues, like unusual anomalies that you saw in the issue breakdown regionally or among demographics?
One thing that was interesting, COVID-19 used to climb the charts, of course. We had it at about 25-30%. At some point, people were worried about the future of downtown and what was going to happen. Now it's at 5%. We've spent a lot of time talking about congestion and transit and whether there's going to be some changes on how people can access downtown Vancouver. And it's at 2% congestion, it's at 2% transit. It's not something that is resonating particularly with people. And it's ultimately about housing, but there's some nuances to this, particularly because of the way in which supporters of different parties are looking at things. You could be concerned about housing because you want more, or you could be concerned about housing because you want less. And I think this is one of the trickiest situations for the campaign. How do you engage with this group, which is worried about an issue, but may not be worried about the issue in the same way you are?
The other issue you asked specifically about, and I didn't put this into our show notes, Matthew, so you'd have to open up the actual tables to see the full spreadsheet, is on SOGI inclusive education. And you asked whether people support or oppose its use in the city of Vancouver. I like that we see 68% of people overall are supportive. What did you find interesting in the breakdowns there?
It's remarkably similar to the numbers we had in 2019 when we asked all Canadians about this. There's a very low level of opposition to this policy at 18%. But what is really crucial to me here is the level of strong opposition, which is at 5%. So the group that is dead set against this is very small. It's also 13% of those age 55 and over. So you may have some people who are reacting very poorly to this. I think it's important to note that if we go back 4 years, there's been a significant change in the way people are looking at SOGI and the way people are looking at gender identity, particularly because of everything that's happened over the past 4 years. And the fact that you have a very high level of support across all demographics, especially when you look at the vote for mayor. You have 72% of Stewart voters in 2018. You have 68% of Singh voters in 2018 who say this makes perfect sense. This is something that we should be doing. And we've seen Fred Harding trying to not talk about his previous statements on this issue back in 2018. And he has been unsuccessful in shaking this. And there's a significantly large pool of likely voters who believe that this isn't something that should be discussed in the way that he wanted it to be discussed. I think it's going to continue to be an issue for him as the campaign rolls along.
So for the people who are dead set against SOGI, do you find that's a more important issue in their hierarchy of issues than...
No. It's one of those things. It's very rare to find people who will vote primarily on the school board and what the school board is doing, and then move towards the parks board or the council or the mayoral candidate. It's usually the other way around. And we haven't seen the final list of school board candidates, but we no longer have the situation that we had before with the Nikki and Wu, for instance, where that core vote that was dead set against specific policies was going to be there, or the situation that they have in other municipalities such as Chilliwack. Right now, this isn't something that is resonating as much as they probably assumed it would. they're working with a playbook that is 10 years old. And I think that is part of the problem here.
So let's come back to the race for the mayor. And Kennedy Stewart's clearly out in front. He'll be much happier with this poll than with the one that was leaked from Team or some of the others that we've seen recently. But one thing I found interesting in the breakdowns is looking at the votes for 2018, is Kennedy Stewart's only holding on to 60% of his vote from that time. And Ken Sim is interestingly holding on to 59% of his vote from last time, which he's in a different party now. So he's managed to at least bring those from the NPA to ABC. But then Shauna Sylvester's voters are going all over the place, with the plurality actually going over to Colleen Hardwick.
The Sylvester vote is fascinating because you see a little bit of leakage, if you will, towards Sim and Kennedy Stewart. But you have 58% of Shauna's voters who are looking at Colleen Hardwick or Mark Marison. And it's a 17% chunk of the vote in 2018 that could really make or break things. When you have a candidate that is ahead by 5 points with a 5-point margin of error, this is essentially a tie. And it's ultimately about how you can sustain this type of momentum. Colleen's numbers are interesting because the gender gap is significantly pronounced. She's at 12% with men, but at 23% with female decided voters. And this is something similar to what we saw with Shauna in the early stages of the race. This is somebody who is a woman. We identify with her as female voter, certainly more than how people felt about Y Young the last time around. But now you look at the five top candidates, and the only woman is Colleen. And I think that is part of the reason for women to look at her as somebody they would vote for. She's at 21% with younger voters. But again, younger voters are all over the place. You have Kennedy Stewart and Sim at 25%, Marison and Hardwick at 21%. Marison's complication, in a way, is the way in which the vote starts to drop as people age. He's at 7% with Generation X and at 1% with the over 55. So clearly...
Can I just point out, you keep saying Gen X when it's 35 to 54, and I'm 36, and I'm definitely not Gen X.
Wow.
Yeah.
It worked 4 years ago.
Yeah. Like, I turned 35 like a couple days ago. Okay. I'm
Fair enough. The middle-aged demographic.
Yeah.
Let's say it like that.
It's more accurate. It still hurts.
I am closer to the next demographic now, so I'd rather be Generation X for a little bit longer than say I'm almost at the threshold of the 55 plus.
But yeah, it does seem like as soon as people turn 35, they stop paying attention to Mark Marison's campaign.
And this is also interesting because he's worked in campaigns. He knows how to get the vote out. I think there's going to be a massive movement to try to get those younger voters to be motivated enough to cast the ballot. And we're going off an election with a dismal voter turnout. And part of the essence for the two minor candidates, if you will, to try to get things done is going to be to connect with new voters. But when you're at 1% with the 55 plus, knowing that this is the group that votes the most in elections, it's going to be a very steep climb.
So does that actually create problems when you're making your likely voter model, when you don't have a long electoral history for someone? Or are there any kind of like general set of assumptions that you make about the voting patterns or voter turnout among younger voters?
It really depends on the election. And for municipal, it's quite interesting. Because what you have is people who are very engaged, regardless of the age that they have. And you start to look at the groups, and the 18 to 34-year-olds will have this very committed group of people who know what they're voting for, who know the way in which the ballot is established, and who have participated in elections in the past. Now, the reality is, if you were to ask 100 people from that group, you're going to get about 25 or 30 who are committed. When you ask 100 who are 55 and over, you're more likely to get somewhere from 60 to 65%. This is why the group gets smaller. These are people who are going to be casting a ballot, but they're not going to be in the same rate as the over 55s. And this is one of the crucial aspects when you're making your likely voter model. Are there groups that are going to be participating more than the last time? Because every election is different. And we'll have to figure that out as we get closer to the election. But you do have a significant number of 18 to 34-year-olds who say, I didn't vote the last time, and I'm not planning on voting the next one.
So just on the numbers themselves, I think there's not much to say about Fred Harding other than these are shockingly bad for him, like 4% overall and not really prominent with any demographic once you consider the margin of error.
You need to look at this, I guess the column that I concentrate on looking at Fred Harding would be the sim vote in 2018, and that's 6%. So if you're thinking about a situation where you're holding on to the level of support that went to the party candidate, it's 6%. And it's definitely not enough to make this a race that is going to be successful. He's at roughly the same level of support that he got in the last election with a party that was not the NPA. So it's clearly not a fantastic situation for the NPA.
And that's consistent with other pollsters. It's not, I think you're likely to be very wrong here. It seems the NPA really did destroy themselves over the last 4 years.
I think part of what happened here, and it's the fact that you were in a position where you were establishing your candidate for mayor at a significantly early moment in the race. And now this is possibly the first poll that has his name. I was disappointed because I was halfway through this poll when Cooper decided to announce that he wasn't no longer the NPA candidate. And I had to throw everything out the window, which wasn't fun. But this is, in essence, where the NPA stands right now. And this plays a role in the way people are looking at their chances for council as well. You're used to that down ballot support. And when your candidate is at 4%, you just don't have that. This is why we didn't have any councillors selected from any party where the candidate for mayor got less than 10%. Nobody who ran for Bremner or with Bremner, nobody who ran with Chen, and nobody who ran with Fred or with Wyong.
Did you get enough data on that poll before you had to throw it out to compare how Cooper was doing with the NPA versus Fred Harding? Or
at the halfway point, it wasn't fantastic for Cooper. I think it was around 6 or 7%. Now that I recall.
Okay, so like consistent with what we've seen in other polls for Cooper. One thing that I wanted to dig into a little bit was in Colleen Hardwick's numbers, there is a substantial dip in support in the middle age bracket, 35 to 54. And is there like an issue profile, or is there a particular reason that you think like less than half of the percentage of people who are supporting her in the 18 to 34 age bracket and almost half of the people who are supporting her who are 55 plus would be supporting her in that middle age bracket?
What's crucial here for me is partly it's the level of support for Stewart. He's at 46% with the 35 to 54s. I won't call them Generation X again. And if you add Ken Stoltz and Colleen Stoltz, you're at 41%. So even if under a different situation, all of those votes were on the same column, you still have Kennedy Stewart ahead. Now, you don't have that same situation when you're looking at the younger or the older demographic. So part of the reason for this is that this is a group that is connecting very well with the mayor. And it's one of the situations that has Colleen's numbers a little bit lower. She does well with young people at 21%. She does well with 55 plus. But I think part of what they were hoping for was a revival on the West Side. She is from there. She's talking about neighborhood character and building things differently. And she's at 14%, so a little bit higher than Marison and very low if you compare it to the numbers that Ken Sim is getting. We would have a closer race, let's say Ken and Colleen both in the 20s, if the numbers from the West Side were tilting towards her, and they're not doing that right now.
And I guess the final thing to look at the numbers is regionally for mayor, Kennedy Stewart unsurprisingly doing very well, 40% in the East Side, 37% as well downtown, with Ken Sim at 36% on the West Side. Colleen Hardwick's actually pretty low on the West Side at 14%, though.
Yeah, this is the part, if I were looking at the numbers from Colleen's standpoint, this is the number that needs to change a little bit. I think she's connecting well on the East. She's connecting reasonably well downtown, but 14 on the West is a very low number. I think they were expecting probably at this stage to be near the 20 level, maybe higher than 20. And that makes this a three-person race. Right now, it's a two-person horse race with a couple of candidates who are very credible and who are closer to getting to that level. Mark's growth has to come from a significant number of places in order to get him closer to where Ken Sim is. For Colleen, it's ultimately about connecting with the West Side. I have a solution for the problems that you are facing, which is going to be more successful than what Ken Sim is offering. So it's ultimately moving that 36% from Ken down and that 14% for Colleen up, and then we could have a situation where you have three front runners instead of two.
Do you see any potential for big shifts in this race, or are there any places that you think are particularly unstable?
I think there's a couple of issues at play. One of them is 16% undecided is big, and it's 20% undecided with women. So it's a group that wins elections. And if that group starts to coalesce around Colleen, it could be a significantly closer race. Or if they start to go back into maybe we shouldn't change things and we should stay with the mayor we know. Similar situation with the 35 to 54-year-olds. Right now, they're trending significantly in favor of the mayor. But you also have 22% undecided on this group. So if this group breaks exactly the same, then that could be significant for Stewart's chances. But I think the movement is more than anything regional. Downtown is having a significant level of support for Stewart. To me, the key continues to be the West Side. If you start to have that 50% of people who say they're voting for Ken Sim or Colleen Hardwick moving from one column to the other, this would make for a very interesting race in the final stages.
Well, Mario, this has been super informative and a ton of fun. Do you have more polls coming out or planned before the election day?
I hope we can do at least one more. I think it'll depend on other commitments. We have the election in Quebec as well that we need to focus on. And hopefully we'll try to do something in other jurisdictions as well. It would be so much easier if we amalgamated, but let's not get into that one later.
Thank you.
Housing was the top issue in the poll, Matthew, and it seems like the top issue for at least two political parties in town. On Tuesday, we were delivered the housing plan from one city, and then that afternoon, either coincidentally or perhaps spurred on by one city scooping them, we have Progress Vancouver also releasing a largely similar plan, to be honest.
Yeah, they're very the same.
They like houses a lot.
They like houses, and they have similar solutions as to how to get more of them. They recognize that there is a giant problem with housing supply. They seem to, like, everyone seems to have finally come around to the idea that this is a supply-side problem. We don't have enough houses for the people who want to live here.
To be fair, we haven't heard the team housing solution yet.
There won't be one. I am fascinated. I yearn to see it, if only for the lulls. But one city. What did they say in their platform? One, the homes we need.
Yeah, they're releasing their platform under the title You Belong in Vancouver, and they're having three ideas. The first is the homes we need, the second is community power, and the third is to come. The homes we need, they are going to end the apartment ban. They will allow six-story rentals everywhere in the city. They focused their graphics on Shaughnessy, showing what it would look like to build a six-story apartment building in the Shaughnessy neighborhood over top of some of the existing mansions. And they flagged that they would include street-level small retail in all of these. So it's not four floors in condo, or it's not four floors in corner stores, it's six floors and street retail. But they, if you're going for condo, it would only get four floors. This is actually the exact same as what Progress Vancouver said, and a secondary bullet, only they don't talk about street level retail. But in both cases, yeah, six-story retail, six-story rental, and four-story condos everywhere, all without public hearings, all approved by staff.
Yeah, it's that no public hearings thing that is interesting, because public hearings are one of the big areas where the Vancouver process, as it currently exists, manages to slow down and stymie the creation of new housing, because it effectively creates a engagement veto for communities, for the people who are like already able to and have the resources and have the time to take time off and go and speak at a public hearing.
I think the best way to continue to go through these platforms is to really just compare them and contrast, to draw out the differences. In an article with Dan Fumano that came out about the One City platform, Mark Marison didn't object to the proposal. He said zoning changes should be phased in instead, focusing on schools and transit first. And the first top line bullet of their platform talks about multi-unit housing being immediately allowed around schools, playgrounds, and transit. But then they go into eventually allowing six-story rentals and four-story strata everywhere. In either case, a lot more housing would be allowed without the public hearings. One city also says that social housing should be allowed to go higher and faster than for-profit housing. They don't really get into exactly what that means. And in both cases, both would deal with the Vancouver Affordable Housing Agency and allow it to become a developer in some way or form. One city talks about allowing that agency itself to just be a public social housing developer. Progress talks more about creating a new Vancouver-specific housing corporation to build mixed-income housing that could fund itself by the market rentals to then also subsidize some affordable rentals. I think the one city approach would be far more public housing or social housing focused, but I wasn't 100% clear.
Yeah, like I think that the Vancouver Civic Housing Corporation model is an interesting one because it takes the problem of the fact that building mixed income housing, which is in general shown to be like quite positively received and beneficial for communities, tends not to be very profitable when you have to build these below market rates alongside market rates. If you're able to take the fact that you don't need to make profit and are instead just funding the creation of new houses, which you can also do with like land banking, which the city has a lot of, there is, I think, a strong case to be made that Progress's plan is like an innovative solution to this particular problem. And one that is, I think, probably better at self-funding than One City's.
Like I might just be wrong. One City might have a self-funding model in mind. They just haven't fleshed it out as much as Progress did. One thing One City does say is they would ask the province to give the city and their housing agency the right of first refusal on any residential land that comes up for sale. This would mean that if you're going to sell your house in Vancouver, the housing agency would be able to buy it before it went on to MLS, for example, and then turn it into housing. This offended the more free market approach to some extent that's in the Progress.
That's a little much for me.
So they argue this is a model that's been introduced in Montreal and has been somewhat successful there. I can't see the city buying every single piece of land. They just don't have the capital to do that. But the city does have access to a lot more credit than your average person. So this could be a way to increase the holding of public land quite quickly.
Yeah, it's interesting. I would want to see more on how that played out in Montreal before passing final judgment, but it is quite an intervention in the housing market that should be very carefully thought out if we're going
to. It's a way to differentiate One City from Progress on housing. And I think those are useful things because it's like, oh, we have two urbanist parties here. There's now we have a clear one where one is here, we're left on this. We will take the land and make it public. And the other one's like, eh, let's just let the market do a bit more of it. And to be clear, both are pro-social housing and affordable housing, and even owned by the public. It's just whether the province should or the city should be grabbing the land as fast as it can.
Yeah, and Progress seems to have a slightly different idea of how to grab land, or at least value from land, and that's the luxury home surtax on the top 1% of homes.
Yeah, that's unique to them. Both talk, One City is reiterating their land value tax. That's not in Progress's plan. I don't think they're against it, though, but the land value tax is something One City talked about in 2018. They actually did get a motion through council pretty quickly and asking staff to report back on it. I did have to go and dig through what the staff report was, and it was a short email at very least that said, our existing combination of DCLs, CACs, and other fees effectively work out to a land value tax, and it would be very complicated to bring a new one in. Yeah, it's not a great answer. Not a real satisfactory answer. Both platforms really talk about expanding the options of housing. So One City talks about allowing more 2 and 3 bed apartments, incentivizing redeveloping single family homes into multiplexes. Progress talks about allowing supporting co-ops, multi-generational housing, allowing seniors housing everywhere. And in some of those also talks about the importance of 2 and 3 bed housing. So both do have a sense that it's not just more houses, but more of houses people can live in.
Yeah, exactly. Because we, like, not everyone wants to live in a condo. Not everyone wants to live in a tower. I think density can be created, like, in substantial amounts of density. Like, European cities aren't that tall. They can be quite dense without being towers. You can do it. And we just need to build that particular type of build form, which we have found so difficult to build in Vancouver because it's difficult to build amongst single family homes.
But Matthew, the shadows and the like culture are destroyed among cities like Paris and Barcelona.
Yeah, that's what I think of when I think of Paris and Barcelona, cultural wastelands.
So mixing in a bit of One City's second plank, community power, with some of the rest of progress. One City talks a lot about renters and the rights for renters in this community power one. Progress would give renters a right of return, including some protections from displacement and rent evictions. One City would go farther and transform the renter's office into a full tenant advocacy office, an agency mandated to advocate for people who were renters. They would also protect cultural hubs, try to completely end displacement incentives, and create a right of return. One City has a focus on homelessness in here, and they would want to put a lot more temporary modular housing on city land. And then there's a whole section on just yelling at Victoria, which they actually both do. Progress asks for a lot of money. One City says they want to see vacancy controls, more public assistance for renters, and to legally recognize tenant unions in apartment buildings so that they have authority to negotiate with the owners and landlords of those buildings, which would be an interesting shift in the political landscape.
Progress seems to have a much more manipulation of the free market approach to things, in addition to the seniors housing and multi-generational co-op housing support. There is that luxury home surtax, as I mentioned, that right to return. This is where things are. It's about removing barriers from the process of development, so streamlining permitting, including pre-approved designs. Pre-approved designs, I think, is one of the best things in the platform, as well as reforming CACs and creating a more transparent fee schedule for CACs. Unique to Progress's plan, though this is probably just because One City didn't mention it, and frankly, it isn't necessarily part of the purview of the mayor, at least in the case of Sinakwa, but it's to support Sinakwa and Jericho redevelopments.
Yeah, the last point in Progress is about supporting Indigenous home development, and they focus on those two projects. And full props to them for explicitly saying that. It's not really up to the city to decide what Sinakwa is going to look like, other than in the agreements for service provision, but saying it is the right thing to do. Two strong housing plans here. Both, ironically, look a lot like some of the stuff from Yes Vancouver in 2018, albeit with, I think, both have a little bit more focus on social housing aspects, although I'd have to really go back and dig through the Yes platform from then. I think both have been pared down in many ways, so they're more readable documents. I remember the size of the Yes Vancouver housing platform, and it's like, we know that three people read that document, a few more on Twitter, but they all listen to this podcast. So, yeah, getting that marketing angle, I think, has been a little bit helpful for both. And both are definitely focused on pitching these as solutions to the number one issue for people in the city of Vancouver.
Housing was the number one issue. Crime was not. However, ABC is going to be pitching some police reform initiatives. And in particular, they're going to request VPD implement body-worn cameras as soon as 2025. What do you think of this?
It's a common request, as I like here that ABC is taking on the challenge of police violence and highlighting that they recognize there are challenges there and concerns and legitimate concerns. We talked on the last episode about a police-involved death, which is even the phrasing I don't like using. A person who died after being shot by six beanbags from the VPD officers. Body-worn cameras are a mixed solution. They're often advocated by police agencies, including the VPD, I believe. And critics argue that it's because it's a way to say, all right, the police need to be cut another check, and that will solve the problems they have. The evidence of their effectiveness is very mixed. In some cases where you have a systemic culture of police oversight, I think they can actually help, and they have been shown to assist in the investigations of police-involved violence or police violence. That said, in other cases, it's just a handout to police to let them get off with other things, and there are many cases in the States where they get turned off and not used. Like, for me, this is just the classic Canadian thing where we see that the U.S. has tried a policy solution for the last 10 years. And we're like, oh, we'll do that now without looking at any of the reforms or evidence or effectiveness of it. We're just like, oh, they were doing that 5-10 years ago, so I guess we should do that now.
Yeah, it's dicey. Speaking of dicey, Colleen Hardwick was speaking with Vancouver is Awesome. about her run for the mayoralty. And hoo boy, was that a hilarious interview.
So this interview is with Mike Howell, and I think he does a great job of pushing back on Colleen repeatedly. She starts off talking about running with a majority. And he's like, again, what happens if you don't get a majority? And she's like, we'll cross that bridge when I come to it. She places herself on the center left side of the spectrum and then regales how she's been involved in the Liberal Party since 1984, before I was born. And then a lot of it is really spent talking about why people think she's anti-growth, anti-development, which she pins all on her enemies.
Yeah, like when she was asked specifically about this anti-growth, anti-development tag, she talks about like her bona fides, her pedigree, her doing a degree in urban geography and poli-sci at UBC and doing urban planning. It doesn't really go into the fact that her voting record is very anti-development. It's, she says, in order to course correct and achieve the balance that we need for the future of the city, we're going to have to deal with some of the changes that Vision Vancouver brought in that have led us in large part to the problems we're facing now. All of this is nebulous, and she doesn't articulate what she thinks these particular problems are, other than the fact that like her voting record indicates that she just doesn't believe that development should be happening.
She, Howell puts that to her and says, you voted against a number of different major developments and rezonings. Why? And she says, they're flawed underlying assumptions. She says that anything that is a strata condo or townhouse by definition is inflationary. Every time you rezone a piece of property, you inflate its value by definition. So if we want to get affordability under control, we have to slow the rate of inflation. But the rate of inflation is also being driven by people moving here and wanting more houses.
Yeah, like I don't think she's right. I think she is completely wrongheaded in thinking that these are inflationary. You need more housing.
No, Matthew, she says we don't know because we don't have the data, and we've approved over 100,000 units. The best kind of 1-2 of questions from Howell, I think, comes in this series about homelessness and what to do. She is asked, you must have some ideas to help, and she references her family's long-term church, which has a parking lot. And she thought, wow, if we could put 10 by 10 units there, the people living there could go into the church and use the kitchen and bathrooms to get the community support. That's the environment that would be helping those people reintegrate into society, which as an atheist, I have a whole bunch of problems with the like coercion and necessary, and even just the humanity. 10 by 10 is a bedroom. Howell then asks, but in February, you voted against council's decision to set up 10 tiny homes in the parking lot of a shelter at 875 Terminal Avenue, a project that on the face sounds exactly the same, but Hardwick reminds us that this is an industrial area. It's been being done by the Luma Native Housing Society. Quote, it's not the same model that I've described where it would be community-based.
So community-based to me means community veto. Like it would go in places where the community has the least amount of political power to resist. I don't think that this is going to be going in Dunbar or Shaughnessy.
And like she says community-based, and a Native Housing Society building tiny homes for people in Railtown, unhoused people, sounds about as community-based as it could be. Dragging people out, like you say, to a church parking lot on the other side of town is antithetical to that.
We should go to my favorite part of the interview, which is the question, what is the biggest misconception of you? And she responds, the right-wing thing, the NIMBY thing, and people saying that I'm anti-development, which for anybody who knows me, knows that's nonsense. I guess she's been keeping her pro-development views to her close circle of friends. These false narratives have been developed and perpetuated by my enemies. And arguably her voting record, my competitors, to be polite, to try and hurt me. And I suppose that is correct in some ways. We are her enemy.
Matthew, my favorite thing is in the second to last question where she says that my PhD, which remains unfinished, is in applied innovation, which to be fair, I have an unfinished PhD in applied innovation as well. Do you have an unfinished PhD in applied innovation?
Yeah, I've barely started working on it, but it's definitely unfinished. It's definitely there.
We'll put a link in the show notes. It's a very interesting read. I do hope Howell grills every candidate as tough as this, and we can make fun of them all.
An interesting article was put out by Justin McElroy. It was on how Vancouver Council votes. We're going to put a link in the show notes to it so that you can look at the voting record. It's some good reading.
Yeah, he tried to pick out the most prominent votes over the last 4 years, including land use, rezoning, finance, and miscellaneous ones. Christine Boyle voted yes on every single one of the things mentioned here. Kennedy Stewart voted no on a couple. Colleen Hardwick voted no on basically everything. She abstained on two. The other half of this that's very interesting is he got answers on from everyone except Sarah Kirby-Young, for some reason, who he tried repeatedly, on what they're most proud of in terms of a motion they brought forward and what motion disappointed them that the council didn't act on. Kennedy Stewart and Rebecca Bly were not disappointed by anything because they both say that all of their motions passed, including many unanimously, which is such a cop-out. Adrian Carr said the same thing, that most all her motions passed, but she was disappointed that a number of things aren't moving fast enough, especially in her words, to ground our plans in delivering on housing to meet the real needs. So she brought housing in there. Like, I think Adrian Carr is really trying to pivot to talk more about housing and to be more pro-housing than she has been.
Yeah, sure. But honestly, actions speak louder than words. And I'm not particularly thrilled by the coming to Jesus moment on housing so late in the game.
One of the places they may put new housing is in Strathcona in Hogan's Alley, as it was announced that the city and Hogan's Alley Society have reached a deal to create a community land trust and mixed-use redevelopment for the site there. There's not a lot of details yet, but I think this is a really historic agreement and opportunity for the displaced Black community of Vancouver to really bring forward a new community for the city and for recognizing the history of Hogan's Alley.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to seeing more details as they come out. I love the mixed use affordable housing and market plus retail redevelopment plans, and I look forward to reading more about it. Moving up to West Van, Nigel Malkin has pulled out of the West Van Council race, stating that his commercial laundry business continues to suffer losses caused by a COVID-19-induced drop in his customer's international airline business.
There's so much to unpack in that single sentence.
Yeah, it's sad. I don't want any businesses to fail unduly, especially because of COVID. But
like, my biggest question is, does he only do laundry for like pilots and flight attendants?
I can imagine like a lot of commercial laundry operations do like major contracts with like airlines for any of the rags that they're mm-hmm. using, everything from like the rags yeah. that they're using all the way up to like blankets and like any napkins and things that, or any kind of cloth that's used in the plane.
Yeah. Malkin was mostly notable in West Van because he was trying to run a really strong the current slate governance in West Van, saying they were too pro-development. He wanted to see direct democracy implemented in West Van. I think he had initially talked about running for mayor under the Civics X West.
The Civic X program.
Except they never registered as a political party.
Yeah.
And then he was going to run for council, and now he's not running at all. So, I don't know. Go back to fighting rapid buses.
In Victoria, a missing middle housing initiative has failed city council 5-4.
Yeah, we talked about this a few months ago, that it had been kicked down the can following a kind of chaos of motions that involved a reconsideration. Ultimately, a newly elected councillor and Ben Izzet and a couple others teamed up for various left-wing NIMBY reasons to say this initiative, which would have said that you could build up all of Victoria, like, It was an upzoning motion. It died, unfortunately.
Some things die, some things are built anew, and one of them is our Vancouverada for this week. We end every episode with a Vancouverada, a little tidbit from Vancouver's history, and this week we are going to be talking about fill-in stations. After things are built, after a SkyTrain line is built, sometimes you decide that you want a station where there is no station but there is already a SkyTrain line. What do? You build a fill-in station. Only one has built yet so far, and that is the Lake City Way Station.
Yeah, this is the station in North Burnaby between Spurling Burnaby Lake and Production Way. It seems to really not be near a lot of stuff. There are some business parks and television studios there, including Global News BC1. As far as I can tell, this was one that the city of Burnaby really pushed for and fought for, saying they would want to fully develop that area. It was opened in November of 2003 after the Millennium Line opened itself in 2002. So it was a pretty quick addition to the Millennium Line, and I believe is still one of the least used stations in Metro Van. So I'm pro SkyTrain stations, and it's a pretty big gap between Spurling and Production Way. So I'm not against this station, but boy, does it feel underused.
Yeah. Looking ahead to other infill stations, what do we have coming down the pipe?
In Richmond, I don't think we've ever actually talked about this one, but it's been slowly chugging along. There's the Capstan station that is going to be built on Number 3 Road and Capstan Way between Bridgeport and Aberdeen stations. This is a station that is uniquely being funded by the new development that's going to be in that area. They're going to have the Capstan Village with space for up to 16,000 new residents and developments nearby. And basically, the developer of that said, we'll give you a bunch of money, City of Richmond and TransLink and everyone else, to put a SkyTrain station in for our development. And it's actually a really great model. The Lincoln station out here in Coquitlam was actually funded the same way, although it was built with the Evergreen extension. Because for some reason, if you know where Lincoln station is, the TransLink wasn't going to put a SkyTrain station right beside the mall at Coquitlam Center. They were happy with the one a little bit further south at the SkyTrain or at the exchange with the West Coast Express. So it has been done before, but it's nice to see this infill station coming to Richmond and adding another line, another stop on the Canada line.
And that brings us to the end of another episode of the Canby Report. We've only got a couple of weeks left in this year's municipal elections. It is a roller coaster of a ride, everyone, and we thank you for being part of it with us. For Leg and Boot Media, I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
Good day.